Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, illegal mining keeps claiming lives as abandoned shafts remain a deadly national blind spot. A fresh push to nationalize pharmaceuticals raises a bigger question about who should control South Africa's medicine supply. Sky-high executive pay is back in the spotlight as boards face tough scrutiny for signing off excessive packages. And South Africans love loyalty rewards, but the growing maze of cards and apps may be costing consumers money. It's Friday, the 14th of August. Fourteen suspected illegal miners have died and eight others hospitalized after a rock fall at a disused mine near Rustenburg in the northwest, with police saying others may still be trapped. Now, the tragedy again raises the question of why dangerous, abandoned mining sites remain accessible and who should be responsible for making them safe. Someone who's applied his mind to that is David van Wyk, who's a mining analyst and researcher with the Benchmarks Foundation. David, welcome to you. What should have happened to this mine when it stopped operating to prevent a tragedy like this? What's the ideal or the recommended protocol here?
Well, the ideal and recommended protocol is contained in various pieces of legislation in South Africa. The Constitution says that everyone has a right to a safe and healthy environment. So that should have been dealt with. The Minerals, Petroleum and Resource Development Act says that the holders of mining rights remain responsible for environmental management, social labor plans, and absolute site rehabilitation through application for an official closure certificate under Section 43 of the Act. Now, unfortunately, in South Africa, the legislation is there, but it's never applied and it's never actually regulated and implemented, because we are changing from large-scale industrial underground mining to surface mining now as the minerals become more and more depleted. Especially in that particular area, there are many shafts that are closing down and thousands of workers are losing their jobs. According to their social and labor plans, they should have been trained in portable skills that they could take to other parts of the economy, which they never were, even though tax deductions were made on the basis of money spent in the social and labor plans for labor, education, and training. And then, of course, the National Environmental Management Act, it imposes a lifetime statutory duty of care according to Section 28, you know, for any environmental degradation, damage and so on caused, you know. And we don't always see the environmental degradation on the surface, because once you go underground, you also degrade the water systems, the geological structures and so on that are there, which also is an impact, especially in places like Rustenburg, where you've got a lot of seismic activity around faults all along the Magaliesberg area, which can cause earthquakes, right, and so on, just like in Johannesburg as well.
So, David, given that the legislation is there, but there's a problem of accountability and implementation, in this particular case, who should ultimately be accountable for making a disused mine safe? Is it the previous owner? Is it the current landowner? Or does the state have a responsibility in that respect?
Well, it's the state and the previous owner or the owner. Owner should not be allowed to walk away from a mine. I have yet to see the government prosecuting a large-scale company for walking away from a mine. And I'll tell you what the problem is. From the first policy gap report that we published, and we've published 14 of them since then, it is a problem of the government not applying the law, because there are politicians on the boards of companies. Every minister of mining that there has been is currently on the board of accounts. Bali Musa, I can name them all, are on the boards of various mining companies and so on. And they are, of course, the BEE shareholders. Now, I've got nothing against BEE. I think BEE is a good thing. But we've got 500,000 graduates in this country that could have been favored with BEE participation in the economy and in mining. Instead, politicians who know nothing about mining are the ones who are actually getting favored. You know, there are lots of engineering, geology, and other students that I come across in the townships that are sitting unemployed, when in actual fact they could have made a major contribution by brought in to participate in mining through BEE structures and so on. You know, so this is what is wrong. We've got the legislation. We've got the right policies. BEE is a correct policy, but it's wrongly applied. Just like our mining and environmental legislation is the correct legislation, but mining companies get away by giving favors to politicians in terms of shareholding and board membership and so on, and then they can take shortcuts.
David, government currently, as I understand it, plans to rehabilitate, I think the figure is 9 mines and seal around 120 dangerous shafts, the timeline 3 years. I would suggest to you that against the scale of the problem that you've outlined to me, that is just simply too slow, is it not?
Too slow, and there's 6,000 of these shafts. And you know, the capping of the shaft doesn't work because they put a cement slab over the top, which anyone who wants to sell scrap metal just simply breaks up the concrete, takes out the cement rods, the iron rods, and go and sell it to scrap metal dealers. And I can take you around Johannesburg, around Main Reef Road. How many of the shafts that they've already capped are actually open again because you can just simply go around it? You actually need to put a plug of 25 meters down the shaft so that no one can actually get around it. But that is not being done. The other problem is that old abandoned mines fill up with water because, you know, it's dolomitic rock mostly. And then the water comes up to the surface. It will push any plug or cap away in time. And the very plug or the cap also then causes springs to come up everywhere. And the springs are acidic and very often radioactive as well. If you go to the West Rand, I can take you to many parts in the West Rand where you can actually visually see these springs that have popped up as a result of the void filling up on the West Rand, also the central void and the eastern void. And of course, the acidic water eats the dolomitic rock below, and that causes sinkholes.
If minerals can still be recovered economically, do you think there's an argument that some abandoned sites be formally reopened to regulated artisanal miners rather than left to the illegal operations as you've outlined to me?
Well, I think it's a combination that should happen. I think the artisanal miners should be allowed in because there is still some gold in there. It's not viable for large-scale industrial mining with huge amounts of labor and so on, but at least some people can put some food on the table when they do that. You know, so I think that is definitely a viable option, and it should be considered because there are many people in South Africa, you know, with the high levels of unemployment and so on, who wish to go into artisanal mining. But also, I think the current legislation that the government is proposing and that was put on the table 2 days ago, unfortunately, is too bureaucratic and cumbersome for it to be actually applied to people who are semi-literate and sitting in township unemployed and so on, wanting to do this work. Many of the former mine workers would like to do this work as well. The legislation also makes it illegal for foreign mine workers to be involved. And the apartheid history that we have, mostly migrant workers were foreign, and South Africans were excluded from mining, expected to work on the farms under apartheid instead. And so South Africans would benefit from an alliance with foreign mine workers, forming small cooperatives and businesses to actually get at these minerals.
And just finally, it's beyond just the mining orbit itself. Many of these mines we know sit alongside communities where unemployment is extremely high. Is it possible, do you think, to solve illegal mining without creating bigger, more legitimate economic alternatives for people living around and beyond these sites?
Well, you look at Belcom and you look at Jagersfontein in the Free State, for example. One produces diamonds not too far away from the other, which produces gold. During the arms deal, a jewelry factory was actually set up in Virginia That jewelry factory failed because they paid the woman who worked there less than the taxi fare to get there, and all the women worked walked away, and they imported cheap labor from Peru instead. You know, so that's just one of the scandals in the arms deal that never actually came to light, that should actually come to light. But that's what you should be doing. You should be creating things like jewelry factories, cutting and polishing shops and so on, and training local communities to do that. You know, because African people are generally very artistic and creative, and you know, they would certainly make a great contribution to the global jewelry industry as well.
David van Wyk, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me, mining analyst, researcher at the Benchmarks Foundation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a major union wants government to take direct control of pharmaceutical manufacturing in South Africa, arguing that essential medicines are simply too important to be driven by private profit. Giwusa says roughly 2,500 direct jobs and 9 manufacturing plants have been lost in the past 18 months and wants a publicly controlled pharmaceutical company producing essential drugs. It is a controversial proposal that is being tabled. I'm going to talk now to Mametlwe Sebei, who is president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa. Mametlwe, welcome to you. Why nationalize a 150 billion rand industry rather than fix what is preventing private pharmaceutical manufacturing from succeeding? Why are you going for the former?
Well, the problem is that for a privately owned and monopolized pharmaceutical industry, production of medicine is about profiteering and not investment in life-saving medicines, but also active pharmaceutical ingredient that goes into making that medicine, so that we provide, you know, life-saving medicine at an affordable and accessible rate to everybody, including the poorest of the poor, who do not have any means of paying at any rate whatsoever. And the problem is that government, instead of focusing on that, they've simply switched off to a cheaper import, mainly from China, from India, where you have a situation where in today, I mean, 75% of the medication is actually imported, only 25% locally manufactured, and 100% of active pharmaceutical ingredients that goes into making that medication is imported. So local production is plummeting, jobs are being lost, 2,500 already in the past 18 months, and 10,000 more are threatened.
Right.
It's clear that this is not sustainable.
So let me pick you up on the jobs. You claim 2,500 jobs, 9 plants have disappeared in 18 months. What evidence does your union have that state ownership would have prevented those closures?
Well, it is very simple. The problem is the state itself is a main market of the pharmaceutical products. I mean, it's responsible for a big part of the health sector that is servicing over 80% of the population that depend on the public healthcare sector. As I've said, they switch on to cheaper imports. And of course, to say that they must simply buy an expensive import because of profiteering privately owned monopolies is also an attack on the public healthcare system that is already tumbling. What we are saying is that a public ownership that will make sure that medication is produced for need, but also without any profiteering, would make that affordable. But obviously there are issues with experiences of state ownership. What we are saying is that we want state ownership on the basis of democratic control and management of the working class. As I've said, universities are an example of how democratically managed public services actually can be able to function efficiently and effectively in delivering quality public service.
Let me put this to you. The Competition Commission, as you well know, can already act against alleged excessive pricing and abuse of dominance. Why isn't stronger competition enforcement a better solution than state ownership?
The problem is profit as a motivation on and by itself. So what Competition Commission says is that lots of these pharmaceutical products are regulated, as you would know, but regulated in the interest of profiteering, like fuel and so on. Because once you accept the principle of private ownership, you must accept that investors invest for the purpose of making profit. So we have, in this country, by the way, you know, lot of capacity, not only in terms of the technical manufacturing, but, you know, the industrial capacity, the skills, as well as the research in universities and many institutes that can produce a lot of medication, not only the one that we are currently using, but also many others that we are lacking for, you know, the diseases that, are affecting the poor and are simply not profitable for the, you know, pharmaceutical industry in that one.
I don't need to tell you that South Africa already struggles with the performance of several state-owned businesses. Why should taxpayers believe government would manufacture medicines more efficiently?
We have absolutely no faith, Jeremy, on this government. What we are saying is that put that state ownership or public ownership under democratic working class control. What do we mean? Let's take an example of, you know, public education and public, you know, healthcare. Public healthcare has been a disaster. There, the minister appoints the CEO, management, and that's the reason you have situations that you have in Tembisa where $2 billion was stolen in one hospital. Look at public education as an example. Higher education, you have councils that are made up of democratically elected representatives of students, of workers, of academics, of communities through local councils. Many of these universities are an envy of the world, and they've completely outcompeted the private sector and private education. Why? Because the ministers and the corrupt politicians are not responsible for the appointment of the management, but also where there's been insourcing, lots of this corrupting interest, private interest have been taken out of this public education, and this education system has been delivering miracles.
So
that's the kind of model we are talking about here.
So let me ask you this then, what exactly would you nationalize? Would it be every manufacturer? Would it be selected plants or only the production of essential medicines? And who pays for those assets and where does the money come from?
Well, we want to nationalize, you know, mainly the monopolies. I mean, the industry itself is monopolized. At COC, where we are organizing as CUSA, we are currently negotiating the retrenchment of about 250 workers. That would be one, alongside many other monopolies. The fact of the matter is, we want to mobilize the industrial manufacturing capacity that there is there, the skills of the workers that are currently being laid off, but also the research capacity that is in these institutions, in the universities, and across society, to make sure that we manufacture on the scale required to produce a life-saving medicines for all the people in this country. And indeed, of Southern Africa, because we have seen during COVID, we have had a situation wherein we relied on rich countries which were hoarding life-saving vaccines at a time at which our people were dying here, because they prioritize themselves.
I understand your argument. You're still not telling me where the money comes from.
Well, I mean, nationalization already, by the way, lots of these, of these pharmaceutical industries are actually, you know, being subsidized. But that's not even the point. The point is that you nationalize and expropriate with compensation based on a social need, meaning you only, of course, compensate for those interest like pensions of workers that are invented and other public interest monies that are invested in this. We do not think that profiteering, parasitic.
You've made the point about profiteering. You're still not telling me where you're going to get the money.
To nationalize. No, nationalize does mean the state expropriates.
And how do you pay for compensation?
Well, I'm saying that, there is money in government. You are able to raise that, and government can be able to raise that through increased taxation on big corporations, which they've been reducing their taxation. You know, under apartheid, it was over 50%. Today, it's down to 27%. We want them to be increasing that taxation to raise the money necessary to compensate only those interest and investment that are worth of course, compensation. Mm. We don't think we should be compensating everybody, including those multinational corporations that are responsible for the crisis that we're in today of, unaffordable medication and the crisis that has destroyed this industry in the first place.
There's no doubt it's a contentious issue. We look forward to getting the view from the pharmaceutical industry. And my thanks to Mametlwe Sibei, who is president of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa. Is property making a comeback, or are investors walking into another trap? Join MoneyWeb Deputy Editor Siren Naidu in conversation with Kundai Munzada from Sesfikile Capital and Ian Anderson from Merchant West Investments as they unpack whether property still deserves a place in your portfolio. Discover where the opportunities lie, the risks to watch, and how interest rates, valuations, and market demand are reshaping property investing. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Visit moneyweb.co.za and secure your seat today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South African boards are facing much greater scrutiny over what they pay their top executives. New Companies Act provisions now require public and state-owned companies to put remuneration policies and annual remuneration reports to shareholder votes, while directors already have legal duties to act with care, skill, and in the company's best interests. But could directors themselves eventually face consequences for approving excessive or badly justified executive pay? I want to discuss that with Dr. Chris Blair. He's been on our program before, Group Director at the Remunerations Consultancy 21st Century. Chris, welcome back to the program. Can directors genuinely be held personally liable for approving excessive executive pay, or am I overstating what the Companies Act actually says?
So Jeremy, you stated it very clearly in that what is the duty of directors, and that's to act in good faith and for a proper purpose, the best interests of the company, and with a degree of care, skill, and diligence. But what that means in terms of the Companies Act, in terms of S76, is that they obviously need to do that, but it's in relation to the knowledge and skills that they possess. So it's not a blanket thing if they approve either, say, a job grade for an executive which results in the wrong salary benchmark, or even just approve a salary benchmark that's incorrect. They not fall in foul if they are doing it in good faith with best interests and taking a degree of care, skill, and diligence. But they have to obviously have the background to say that they did do that, and then they are not held personally liable. Where they are liable is where they just neglected the duties, and they cannot prove that they went through the process with their general knowledge and experience and just ignored taking good care.
Chris, I want to come back to that word diligence that you've just used. The Act, as I understand it, requires directors to take reasonably diligent steps to understand what they are approving, all well and good. But could a board still hide behind, say, a remuneration consultant and say, well, you know, that's what Chris told me, that's what the experts recommended?
Yes, exactly. So as a director, and particularly on a board, they have the avenue to use consultants or specialized advice from wherever they get it. But that doesn't leave them not liable by not understanding it and not asking the right questions. So they need to come in, and particularly as 21st Century, as a consultant, I do a lot of executive evaluations, and I get cross-questioned to say, but why is it like that? What makes you get to that conclusion? And the director needs to, particularly the executive directors and non-exec directors, need to be au fait with their company environment, their industry, and all of their particular nuances, that they're the ones steeped in it, so they can ask the right questions. So they can't sort of just go, oh, well, Chris came in, gave us the grade of F1 for the CEO, and now it's on him because the CEO is actually only an E3.
So how does a badly graded job ultimately translate into an inflated pay packet then?
Yeah, so it can be inflated or deflated, Jeremy. Both are equally as bad, but for different reasons. So inflated, so in the marketplace, particularly in South Africa, you run executive salary benchmarks against the grades. Typically, companies understand Patterson, which goes from E1 to F5 or even G1 and G2, which are global. And they established for all the companies in South Africa that are willing to participate, this is the median pay for that rate. Now, if they call me in as an example and I say it's an F1, they're going to look up that salary survey and say we need to offer this CEO an F1 salary with the corresponding short-term incentive and long-term incentive. And if he's actually an E3, that will be hugely overstated. And worse still, the variable pay then gets ratcheted up because it's overstated and it's on a bigger base. So that's the one side, and then that ends up being a waste of company money, to be fair. Shareholder return. On the other side, let's say other way around, I said it was an E3 and it's actually an F1, they're probably going to get a CEO that's not, hadn't got the right set of skills to run a company that size, because normally the company, as the company gets bigger, then obviously the grading goes up. So then they'll struggle with attraction. They'll probably appoint the person without the right set of skills, and that's equally as bad.
Chris, do you think that the gap between the highest and lowest paid employee should play a direct role in deciding what a chief executive earns, given this enormous wage inequality that exists in South Africa?
Sure, Jeremy, that's a wonderful question to ask. So what the new Companies Act, the amendments, the Section 38 and 30B, try to do is to do tests against that, where the company shows what that variation is. Now, the variations alter by industry, they alter by many factors. So it's very difficult to say that's a good one and that's a bad one. Possibly the better question to say is, are we paying the executives at the right level for attraction and retention and performance in terms of shareholder value? And then the better question to ask is, can we pay a living wage to our low-level staff rather than focusing on this wage gap that exists? So that's, I know it's not answering your question exactly, but I feel a bit, I think the ratio itself is fine, but it's just an indicator, and the problem sits at the bottom of the organizations more than at the top. I'm not talking about, there are CEOs who are totally overpaid, but most are not. They're paid for the actual job they do.
Chris, just a final one, and briefly, I did reference in the introduction that I think from May this year, shareholders gaining stronger votes over remuneration policies and reports. Does that actually give shareholders real power, or can boards still largely ignore them?
I think it has. It's really got quite a lot of teeth now, because particularly there's two votes. The one is on the remuneration policy, and that gets voted in for 3 years, and they can't make any changes without going back to the shareholders in those 3 year period. So that kind of protects the policy, assuming that the policy is a good policy and was voted in. The implementation report is how they implemented the policy and the actual numbers in looking backwards for the next each year. Now that's got real teeth, because I think we're virtually a stand under correction. I think one of the only countries in the world that has got, if there are two votes, so it's the two strike rule, if there are two votes against the implementation policy, the actual REMCO has to stand down. And that obviously is quite a big step for shareholders to take. So they would have to think about it carefully, because it does cause disruption. But if they're really unhappy with the way the policy's been implemented, assuming the policy got a good vote, then they can at least say, no, we're not going through this. And then the board has to go back to the shareholders and show them how they've rectified whatever the shareholders were unhappy with.
Dr. Chris Blair, I'm going to leave it there. As always, thank you very much indeed, Group Director at the Remunerations Consultancy 21st Century.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africans love loyalty programs, but actually using them is becoming, I think, increasingly complicated. Listen to this number. The average consumer now belongs to around 9 schemes with cards, apps, barcodes, and passwords all competing for attention at the checkout. The argument is that the next battle in loyalty is not going to be about offering more rewards, but maybe making the rewards we already have easier to use. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation with Byron Rode, who's founder and chief executive officer of MyCards. It's an app, I understand, that allows multiple card storage. Byron, welcome to you. And are loyalty programs these days genuinely saving consumers money or just primarily designed to make us spend more?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Great question. I think they serve dual purpose. I think overall, we are definitely, as a South African consumer, always trying to look out for a good deal. And I think loyalty does have that. But I think it also helps the business to grow their brand and get a little bit more sale.
All well and good. But as I'm having this conversation with you, I've opened my wallet. I'm looking at my loyalty cards. Byron, if I drop my wallet on my foot, I'm going to break it. And this is the question. If consumers belong to an average of 9 programs, I think that's the correct number. Do you think retailers have created too much complexity in pursuit of loyalty?
I definitely agree that they have. I think there's just too many apps these days, too many different programs, and that's exactly what MyCards aims to simplify, is the convenience factor. You shouldn't really have to have multiple things, multiple programs, multiple cards everywhere, and the idea is to give them one convenient app that's easily accessible to you in your phone, which you carry with you at any given time.
And your argument is that people leave money on the table simply by forgetting to scan their cards. I mean, I understand that because often it's just a mission sometimes. How significant are those lost rewards in real rand terms? Have you done any quantification on that?
Yeah, there's some definite significant loss. I use loyalty programs myself, and I will tend to purchase where I can get the best benefit. In some cases, up to 25 to 30% can be left at the door if you leave your card behind. Or, no access to a certain special where you get buy one, get another free, for example. So there are a number of opportunities that are lost if you don't have your card with you.
But the bigger issue, I guess, is that many of us just don't understand what our points are worth and how to redeem them, but particularly about the value that is sitting on our card.
Exactly. And as well as what you can do with that value and how you can stack them and where you can utilize them, where you can double up on certain rewards at certain petrol stations, for example. MyCards is releasing a money tips part of the app to our premium subscribers that will give access to those little tips and tricks and give them better support for these loyalty programs.
I want to come back to what your business offers in just a moment, but do you think loyalty programs deliberately make redemption complicated because unused points, and let's be honest here, ultimately benefit the retailer, right?
Definitely. I definitely think there is a combination of it. In my experience and with our research that we've done along this, there are definite retailers that will make it more difficult. But we are seeing a push, within the industry where people are pushing to have them, retailers are asking for loyalty cards, your coffee stores, etc., which are promoting those things. And I think it comes down to loyalty is more than just the points as well and making customers feel like they are VIP.
So if I put all my loyalty cards onto one platform, and this comes to your offering, what specific information are you able to see about me and my shopping behavior that would ultimately benefit both the retailer and the consumer?
We can take some anonymized data in terms of shopping behavior, so we can see when consumers are most likely to spend, what times of the week and of the day, obviously, and depending on what information is stored, what retailers they're using, we keep that information. It's your personal information. We don't want to know as much about you personally, but we want to look for behavioral patterns, and we can see that. We can see if you choose to shop at one retailer and then go to the next, if you are shopping around for specials, for example. We can tend to notice that in your behaviors, and also notice regular behaviors, somebody that may shop at one retailer once a week and another only once at the end of the month, for example.
And that's extraordinarily detailed data. There's also the argument that customers maybe are trading privacy for discounts.
I think there is an argument for that in some way, and I think loyalty tends to lean towards a discount. But I think if you look at the statistics, 77% of South Africans are a member of a loyalty program of sorts. The nine is obviously the bigger number. That number tends to show that consumers are willing to share that information. At least as much as they are, you know, nowadays with privacy focus and location tracking, etc., being a little bit harder to get that information.
So 77% of consumers allow programs to influence where they, for instance, buy groceries. I'm wondering whether loyalty is now powerful enough then to override price competition.
I think there is definitely a way towards it, and I think you can see that within the retailer programs that are happening, at least in the data that we can start to see. You know, specials are tend to be driven towards loyalty programs rather than away from them. So, you know, we'll see different retailers hedging their bets against each other. One will offer a certain special on their retail program, the next retailer all of a sudden offers it on the other side. So it's definitely influencing decision making at a retailer level.
And just a final question then, do you think with household budgets under pressure, consumers should be treating loyalty rewards as part of their broader financial planning, or do you think that might be overstating their value?
Look, I think it's very difficult to tell what the average person is doing with that. But if I take my own experience and I take the experience from our consumers that give us information, you know, I think loyalty does drive decisions and behaviors around. It certainly does for me, as I've mentioned. You know, I will tend to shop where I know I can get a discount if I'm looking for a particular product. And I think, you know, we're technically we're value conscious as South Africans and are always looking for a good deal.
Byron Rhode, thank you very much indeed. Founder, Chief Executive Officer of MyCards. And that is our program for today and, in fact, for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.